Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk about vehicle maintenance. Jim Ward back with us. He retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota a while back. He was with the company for 36 years, and it's always great to have him stop by. We're going to start out by talking to him about hydroplaning and dealing with water in your vehicle, but of course, we'll take any of your vehicle questions and you can join in. Maybe you're having some problems with your vehicle. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Jim Ward, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's always great to be on with you. Your callers always make any subject more interesting. Looking forward to it.
I tell you what's interesting. What's interesting in a kind of a scary way is when you are in a car that's hydroplaning.
It sure is. Yep. It's scary and it is avoidable. It is avoidable. So that's the important thing. You know, anytime that your tires can't displace the amount of water that they're riding on, they can't displace enough, either because of your speed or because of the water depth or because of the tread depth of the tires, you can get that exciting moment when the engine RPMs go up and you know you're not going to really be fully in control. So as with many things, calm is the important thing. You know, you want to let off that gas pedal easily. Do not brake suddenly or don't do anything suddenly. Just let off the brake, let it slow down suddenly. And, you know, and then from there on, understand that speed control is really, you know, in general acceleration in real wet conditions is what helps prevent it.
Are certain cars or models more prone to hydroplaning?
Well, they are. Oddly enough, this is counterintuitive, but all-wheel drive vehicles are more inclined to hydroplane than two-wheel drive vehicles. Lighter vehicles are more likely to hydroplane than heavier vehicles. And always, it's not so much a type of car, but the deeper tread depth your tires have, the more water they can displace, the less likely hydroplaning is to occur.
Yeah, and it's and replacing those tires pretty important, but there's kind of a rule on it, isn't there?
Well, there is, and that's the thing is that you know there's the legal and the you know the advisory tread depth, which is the legal is 2/32nds of an inch, which might as well be bald. That's enough, you know. And you know often you know a shop will look at your tires and say they're 5/32nds of an inch. They only start out at 9 or 10. So in your mind, you'll say, well, these tires have half the tread left, but you really do have compromised traction and really are a little more prone and in deep water and at higher speeds to have hydroplaning occur at 5/32nds of an inch. Not to say you have to replace tires then, but if you're going to drive on tires that are, you know, at that tread depth, then you need to be extra careful. That's all there is to it.
Yeah. There's a range in cost, you know, for a respectable set of tires. What are we talking about? And do you need to get them put on by a mechanic or should you? I would.
Well, you kind of have to. Most people don't have the equipment that they're going to be able to. It's just not a do-it-yourself job, and you know you have to have some special equipment to be able to take a tire off, put a tire on. You know, particularly with most cars now have tire pressure monitors that are in that air gauge, in that air valve that you add air into, and then once you have the tire on and have air in it, which there are such things as mechanical tire irons that you could, you know, on the floor of your garage, you could take a tire off and put another tire on, but then the tire needs to be balanced, and a balancing machine is a fairly expensive piece of equipment. I don't know anybody that's got a tire balancing machine in their home garage. It's just not real likely. And, you know, if you get a new set of tires, it's a good idea to have an alignment done to make sure that investment is going to wear properly and that you don't have uneven wear. Even if that check is just driving through, a lot of shops have checkers. When you drive through the door and come in, it does a quick check and can tell you if it's likely to be off. So, I mean, those are just things that are not, you know, do-it-yourself things. So, you know, it's pretty important. And the price of tires, it depends on the kind of vehicle you have and the size of the tires. You know, over the years have gone by, tires on vehicles have gotten to be larger and larger diameters, and that means more expensive tires, unfortunately. And, it, you know, but the price range can vary a lot. You know, I replaced tires on my truck very recently, and you know the range of prices from the top to the bottom was almost double, you know, the cost from the top to the bottom. So, you know, you want to look around at what the warranties are on those tires. One of the important things that may or may not get discussed when you're looking at buying tires is something called road hazard, which means if you hit a nail and it punctures a tire and ruins it, or at least, you know, even if it can be repaired, is that going to be covered? And, you know, a lot of tires are sold with road hazard, and sometimes you can purchase it, but it's a good investment. It's a good investment because the tires are expensive and, you can't control when something like a nail in your tire is going to happen. So not that that has much to do with hydroplaning, but you know, tires are an important part of it. If you're going to buy tires, those are some things to be aware of.
You know, I was we had that big storm the other night, and I was out on my—
Goodness.
I was watching through the window when a car went by, and I thought, what are you doing out there? You know, you get into a heavy rain situation, you wind up with a kind of a flooded roadway, and you don't want to drive through a water-covered road, do you?
You really want to think twice. There's a phrase Natural Weather Service has that's called turn around, don't drown. You know, in all my years of working at Smart, and I live out in the country, and I drive a rural route, which, you know, sometimes I have to go over some of these small bridges where you have like a big culvert underneath the bridge. And I remember a few years ago coming to that bridge, and it was heavy rain in the morning, and the fields were full of water. You know, little rivers were running through places that don't normally have little rivers running through them. And this particular culvert and small little, probably only about a 15-foot, you know, bridgeway had water running over the top of it. And the thing is, you know, drive a big truck, I probably could have got through it. But what you don't know is there anything even under that water? It's possible that the culvert and the dirt around it and the roadway got washed away, and you're just seeing water passing through a channel, which, you know, will drag you away. So that's why they say turn around, don't drown. You can't tell by looking at it what the depth is, you know. And it's just so much better off to be cautious than to regret or have something terrible happen.
And, you know, driving through water's got to have some effect on the brakes or maybe even the engine or parts of it.
Well, you know, brakes are made to operate in the wet. They're when you're driving in heavy rain and it's splashing up and driving on the winter, it really isn't so much the brakes. I mean, brakes can have a minimal effect, but the pressures that they operate at, it'll squeeze that water out pretty effectively. But it can affect electrical systems, and if the water splashes up just right to the car's intake, it's unlikely, but it happens. It happens every year a few times to a few people driving through some deep water, that the splash of water, and it takes less than a cup, can come into the engine's intake, the air intake, which is quite a strong air pull. I mean, it's like a vacuum cleaner. You put your hand over and it sucks hard. If that water gets pulled into a cylinder, it can hydrolock your engine. Water won't compress. It might as well be a steel, you know, wheel bearing, steel marble or something that goes in there, and it'll destroy a motor. It'll be like you threw metal in there. It'll just, you know, it'll destroy it. And the thing is, the same thing can happen if your car is in a parking lot somewhere and that parking lot floods and then the water recedes, but you see evidence like inside your car that water got quite high. You really only want to try to start that engine. You should not try to start that engine. That car should be towed somewhere. You know, if you get the feeling that water got over the sill plate and like over halfway up the wheel, that car should be towed somewhere, and it should have the spark plugs removed and the engine manually turned over to make sure there's no water in there. You know, if you do that, everything can be dried out and everything can be saved. But if you try starting it, you can have electrical problems that can short things out, and you can have a hydrolock and engine that can destroy your engine just like that.
Yeah.
So, yep, that's another situation where even though there might not even be water around anymore, but water might have receded, if you see evidence your car was in deep water after it's been setting, don't try to start it.
You know, I'm wondering about insurance. Does auto insurance cover vehicle flood damage?
You know, it does, the thing about it is when you have a big flood event, it doesn't happen often. You know, in my career, there were a handful of times where we had these huge flood events. It doesn't typically, you know, happen to one car. If a region gets hit, all of a sudden repair facilities have all kinds of cars brought in, and insurance companies can get overwhelmed. And although the saddest thing I've seen, the most frustrating thing I've seen, and I'm not going to say I'm blaming the insurance companies because they don't anticipate this kind of thing happening, but if so many cars get affected, they can't come and inspect those cars quickly enough. And that car sitting there with that water in it, I mean, you know, a shop isn't authorized to pull the carpet out and pull the seats out and try drying everything out until an insurance company looks at it. You know, you want them to see that evidence, yet at the same time, it can take days. And during those days, lots of damage can happen just sitting. You know, water sitting there, mold can begin, and electrical corrosion can begin. And, you know, I've seen scenarios where if the car had been inspected and repairs had begun immediately, things would have been fine. But it takes sometimes a few days to a week for the insurance companies to be able to get people out there. And, again, not blaming them. It's just not something that they can anticipate to have enough people on the ground to get everywhere quickly enough to do all those inspections. So, you know, I've seen some sad scenarios where things could have been prevented. And but in terms of coverage, yeah, typically good insurance coverage will cover damage from flood.
Brad in Jefferson has a question for you. Let's go there, I think, on a different matter. Brad, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hey, thanks very much. Looking forward to Bayfield and Bloom next weekend. Hope to see you.
I'll be there.
There you go. And Jim, thanks for bringing the expertise to the show for those of us less mechanically inclined. My question is this. I have a 2011 Infiniti, 207,000 miles on it. It's a good car. I'm tired of putting premium fuel in it. I'd like something more fuel efficient and something that's not quite as elderly as the car and myself. And so I'm just wondering, is this a good time to start looking for hybrids or EVs, or should I wait to the 2025 model year? What's your prediction? What's your crystal ball say about a good time to buy an energy efficient vehicle?
Well, it's always a good time to buy an energy efficient vehicle. You know, the technology is always jumping ahead on hybrids and electric vehicles at just incredible pace. You know, I can't say that I am retired now, so I can't say that I'm on top of all the new models of what necessarily is gonna come out in this next year model. But you know, I'm always on the fence between being an early adopter and adopting a brand new model or something that's come out and looking at something that's been around. You know, for my own taste and my own sanity, I tend to look at the tried and true. If there's a model that's been out there for a number of years and is working well, that's what I'm more inclined to try. Thank goodness there are early adopters out there, though, that are willing to be the guinea pigs and try those things out and see how they work. You know, the thing to do is to get out there, kick some tires, talk to some dealerships and take a look at what's out there and what some of the benefits are. And as important as anything else, when you do that, you want to, you know, I don't know, you know, what you do for service on your own vehicle, but particularly if you get, you know, as you mentioned about not being mechanically inclined yourself, if you're not going to fix your own vehicle, and the more we get into electric and hybrid vehicles, the less inclined people are to do that. You want to find a vehicle that you're going to be taking somewhere that you're comfortable with them and have a good rapport with them in fixing it. So that's about as important as the specific technology or brand that you buy, that you are comfortable with the dealership, the shop, wherever you're going to take it.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Brad, thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison, with the company 36 years. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your vehicle today on the program with our guest Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. He's been with us many times. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Chris and Adams, we'll go to you now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I was driving to Chicago one day, and it was raining out very hard, and the infrastructure on the freeway ramp couldn't take care of the water, and I didn't realize it because I couldn't really see very well. And I hydroplaned on the ramp, hit my left front bumper on one of the guardrails, spun around, hit the right front bumper on the other guardrail, and ended up backwards on the freeway ramp. So I said a little prayer, made the fastest Y turn you ever saw in your life. When I got to Chicago, I bought a very expensive bottle of champagne for my friend and I.
Yep, good idea, man. You want to celebrate those little wins. Holy smoke, that sounds scary. I mean, it's just like being in the winter on ice, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, Chris, you were safe, though, right?
Yes, I did okay. Lunch was really good.
What kind of car? What kind of car was that in, Chris?
It was a Toyota Celica. I think if I had been in anything bigger, I probably would have gotten smashed by a truck.
Ooh. Yeah, being familiar with your own car definitely has advantages. Yep, and especially in situations like that.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. I'm sorry you went through that, but probably made you an even more careful driver. I really appreciate it, your call. Well, if you're the inside of your vehicle, somebody had a question on that. If it's not properly dried out, you can run into all kinds of problems. And how do you dry it out?
Well, basically, if water's gotten into the interior of the seats, you want to remove the seats. You want to remove the carpeting. Underneath the carpeting, there tends to be another mat, which is often some type of fibrous material at all. We remove those, suction out the water with a wet vac as best you can, and then hang them and have blowing air or heat or some kind of drying, going across them, because you want to dry them out just as quickly as possible. And then it depends on what has happened to them. How long they've been wet. If they've been wet for a while, then you want to put some kind of agent on it that's going to slow any kind of mold buildup. And you have to be careful. Hydrogen peroxide is good at that, but it can also change the color of things. So, you want to be, you could put hydrogen peroxide in a water solution in a spritzer and spray it on things. But again, it sometimes can bleach things a bit. So you've got to be a little bit careful. But you want to get things out of the car and get them drying as quickly as possible. It's like, you wouldn't believe what it looks like when we take a car apart in a shop that's been in a flood. They're just, there are things spread out all over the place to try to get all of the interior out and get it all dried and drying.
Oh, man. Marilyn in Milton has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, good morning. I had bought my first Toyota vehicle. It's a Highlander 2023 with the turbo. And I was thinking that when you start it up, time should let it idle for 2 minutes.
I missed part of your question there. You sort of broke up. So when you start, what were you saying?
When you start the car up and it's cold, you should let it idle for about 2 minutes before engaging it.
Should you have to do that?
Is that a question? Well, the engineers who design the car don't really design it with any warm-up in mind. That being said, they're not often thinking it's 20 below. I would say that if the temperatures are below zero, and the more below zero, that it is not a bad idea to let it warm up a little bit. But at temperatures down to zero, it really isn't necessary. The engine will warm up the best. It will be the most efficient by starting it up and driving it. It's really designed to operate that way. But again, if it's cold enough, we live in Wisconsin, we know what it can do. Warming it up for a couple of minutes is not a bad idea.
Marilyn, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. This is a question I have on the Toyota pickup trucks with the bad frames, the recall. I have a 2001 that I bought new. I still have it. Nice truck. I put it away in the winter. I don't want to drive it in the salt. When that recall letter came to me, I brought it to a dealer in Green Bay. Supposedly, they power washed it, and undercoated it. Was that a good idea with the undercoating? And another question I have is, why did those frames go bad? Was it bad steel? Too thin of steel? What does Jim know about it?
That was a 2003.
Yeah. I said it was an 01, but either way, it was a problem with the steel, and it was a problem with how the steel was treated. The frames were made by Dana Corporation for Toyota, and ultimately they struggled with that problem for a number of years. It's one of the most unfortunate stories in the history of Toyota is, but there was a problem with the metal, the final treatment of the metal. And ultimately, it isn't really a rust proof that they put on it. It's a corrosion preventative, which is a little bit different than a rust proof. A rust proof is a coating that's designed to be put on something brand new. A corrosion preventative is something more along the lines of like Rust-Oleum paint that you can paint on something rusted that's going to convert that surface, you know, that corrosion to something else. The problem is that, you know, with metal like that, you can get pits and it can get in there deep enough that is a Band-Aid. That's something that might get you a few more years out of it, but it's not going to cure the underlying problem. And it didn't. And unfortunately, lots of people experienced that problem in Toyota. You know, they went further than most any manufacturer would in replacing frames on vehicles and doing claims that were, you know, $15,000 to $20,000 claims on vehicles, you know, partly just to be able to say that they, you know, that they tried to stand behind them. But it was a material problem to begin with, and the treatment that was done again was something to buy some time for those frames, but not a cure.
Lee, thank you for calling. Let's go to Janie in Elkhorn. Hi, Janie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a bit of a friendly disagreement with a friend who has a small self-contained RV. In the wintertime, she usually has the batteries taken out and stored, and I couldn't tell you exactly how she stores them. But the rest of the time, if she's not using the RV, she'll go on a weekly basis and just run, idle the motor for about 5 minutes, thinking that that's going to keep her batteries charged up. My three shade tree mechanic sons told me back in the 90s, you need to drive at least 5 miles at least 35 miles an hour to keep a battery charged. And I wonder, can you settle the argument for me?
Sure.
Well, I don't know if I can settle it because, but I'm going to say that I tend to agree with your shade tree mechanic friends, and I don't even know that I would say 5 minutes at 35 miles an hour is enough. It needs to be driven. It would be better to drive it more like 15, 20 minutes. And part of the reason I say that isn't even just the battery. It's to get moisture out of the engine, out of the exhaust system. But for the battery and the charging system's sake too, yeah, running it for 5 minutes, you know, a battery is a piggy bank that you are making withdrawals and doing deposits in. And that 5 minutes of running is more of a withdrawal than it is a deposit. You're taking a certain amount of power out of the battery to start the vehicle. And in my opinion, sitting there running for 5 minutes is not enough of a deposit to cover the withdrawal that you just made. So, you know, I would agree that it should be driven. And again, I would go even a little further. I think 15, 20 minutes really is what it should be. And if you can get up to highway speed, that would be best.
Yeah, so 15, maybe, highway speed rather than, as Janie's friend was doing, was just let it idle for 5 minutes.
Which, you know, maybe better than nothing, if you're doing anything for the battery, it's very, very minimal at 5 minutes. And you may again have taken more out of it than you put back in under that circumstance.
Okay, Janie, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Why does the windshield on your vehicle seem to always fog up during warm rains?
Well, it's because you breathe. You have to stop breathing. No, I always kid the vehicle, people in my vehicle. It's because the moisture is accumulating in the vehicle at a faster rate than you're getting it out of the vehicle. So the ventilation system is designed to handle that. And then in almost every vehicle, when you put your ventilation system in a defrost setting, it turns the air conditioner on automatically. And some vehicles are more sophisticated and have humidistats that will turn that on if the humidity level is high enough, and not have it on necessarily if it isn't. But the majority of vehicles don't have that, and it just is on if you've got it on defrost. So, if you have had to walk two blocks from your office to your car in the rain, and you get in the car and you're completely wet, you've got your raincoat on and it's dripping off your raincoat onto the floor, and your shoes are wet, now you've got, you know, wet You know, it isn't even just your breath. Our breath has lots of moisture in it. And, you know, obviously a car with six passengers as opposed to one is going to have a lot more moisture building up. So it's that you've got more moisture in the car than you're getting out of it. So, you know, turning it on to frost, turning it on high, getting the air movement at a higher rate is what you want to do. Ventilation systems in cars have a setting called recirculate. It's for the efficiency so that you're not taking in fresh air from the outside. And you do not want to use that when you're trying to defrost. You know, if you put it on recirculate, then you're just keeping that moisture in the car. So you want to make sure you have it on fresh air if you're starting to get a lot of that kind of buildup on the windshield. And some of the less likely scenarios and unfortunate cases, particularly in colder weather and wintertime, if you're seeing that buildup, sometimes that can be a sign that you've got a leak in your heater system. The heater system works off the antifreeze from the motor that keeps the motor cool, and those systems can develop a leak that will make it fog up pretty badly inside the car. That's often associated with an odor, too. Antifreeze tend to have kind of a sweet, syrupy, almost like pancake syrup smell. Again, that's pretty unlikely, but that can be a cause. That's particularly more noticeable in the winter when you're using heat and stuff like that. But if you just can't seem to get on top of it, that may be a problem you've got. But most of the time, it's just that you're wet, you're breathing, your breath has got a lot of moisture in it, and you need to use the defrost and heat to kind of get the exchange rate so you're getting drier air inside the vehicle quicker than it's accumulating.
John in Chippewa Falls will go to you now. Hi, John.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Morning, John.
Yes. Yes, good morning. My question is, I'm looking to buy a used 2023 GMC pickup truck. I'm looking at the 1500 with the 3.0 liter and the 2500 with the 6.6 liter, both diesel. And just want to find the appropriate truck to pull a trailer, let's say an Airstream that weighs 7,200 pounds. Just want to get a recommendation on what's the appropriate truck for trailering across country.
What's the weight of that Airstream?
About 7,200.
Okay, that's fairly light. That should be well within the range of what that 1500 can do. You'd have to look at the specs, but I'm sure the 1500 is at least weighted there to about to 7,500, if not more, maybe closer to 10,000, depending on how the rest of the vehicle is equipped, what the gearing and stuff is. But that is within the range of a 1500. You know, if you're going to be going out west and going through mountains and really high, steep elevations and stuff like that, you have more power, obviously, with the bigger engine, but then you're going to, you know, pay for that with the fuel economy, which that's quite a difference between the 3 and the 6.6. So, but the 1500, the 3 is definitely capable of pulling that weight.
All right, John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. John in Altoona, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a car that had pretty poor traction several years ago. It was a 2005 Saturn Ion. And so I started running snow tires in the winter and just never changed them. So I started running them all year round. And then a police officer friend of mine said that they run snow tires all year as well for good traction. I thought you guys were talking about hydroplaning and traction. And is it actually a benefit to run snow tires all year? Is it safer? Is it advised?
Okay.
Well, it is. I mean, I run snow tires on one of my vehicles, and the one thing though is that certain snow tires, and so they tend to be the best of the snow tires out there, have a rubber compound that really will start to wear at a much higher rate when the temperatures are consistently above 50 degrees. So you're probably not going to get the life out of those tires, and you know that is a compromise or a trade-off that you know, for the additional safety, you might be very willing to give up is not getting the tread life, the mileage that you would have out of those tires otherwise. But that is the one caveat, is that the rubber compound is softer. It's primarily meant to be used below 50 degrees. So, but in terms of the performance of the tire and on the road, it's superior. There's no question.
All right, John, there you go. Tom in Marquette, Michigan, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, and appreciate your show, and thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a plug-in hybrid.
Okay.
And we've got a Toyota RAV4 Prime, and we can it's great because we can do all of our chores around town because we can drive up to 40, sometimes over 40 miles just using the electric motor. But then our question is, we've got gas in the tank that's getting old. And also, you know, does that gas need to be refreshed once in a while? And also, what about changing the oil in the engine? If we're primarily using the electric motor, how frequently should we change that engine oil?
I'm a strong believer in preventative maintenance. And, you know, engine oil is more expensive, and oil changes are more expensive than they used to be, but they're still much cheaper than engines. We live in a state where we get quite a climate variation from hot to cold. When we go from hot to cold, if we run an engine and get it, you know, run a vehicle and get it warm, even though you're using electric and not getting the gas engine as warm, you are going to create some condensation in that engine. And that is a good reason alone to just change it at the interval that's recommended, which is going to be a time or mileage, whichever comes for a situation. It may be 6 months, 5,000 miles, 1 year, 10,000 miles, but that oil should be changed. It's just cheaper insurance. And then in regard to the other question, in terms of the gas, you know, there's a product called Stable, and there's other products that are similar that are used to keep gasoline. Doesn't sometimes some gas is cheaper than others, but all gas eventually will break down and gums begin to form in it. And, you know, you can put Stable in the gas. It's a liquid. It'll tell you how much to put in, you know, for how many gallons are in the tank. And that will ensure that the gas lasts a lot longer, doesn't start to break down as quickly. So in a situation like that, you know, it's fantastic to have a vehicle you can drive on electric like that with your primary needs. But you're right, that gas in the tank is sitting there, not being used. It will break down over time. So that's what I would do. I would use Stable, and it's the same thing that I do with I use it in all of my machines. Absolutely everything I put gasoline and I put Stable in it to try to prevent any kind of problems that could be related to the breakdown of the gasoline.
I do the same thing. Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Open lines now get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address ideas, talk at WPR.org. Talk at WPR.org. Vern from Eau Claire County says some kind of truck frames seem like they're designed for their frames to rust, especially Chevy and Ford. He's painted over his truck's frame, and it's helped it not to rust.
Well, the manufacturers would tell you that, you know, that it's not a design problem or manufacturing problem or a quality problem of the materials, that it's a climate problem and a use of salt. I mean, you can take a frame, you know, go down to Arizona, go down to the southwestern part of the country, you'll see cars from the 50s and from the 40s even that are still in great shape because they haven't been exposed. So environment, an environment where salt is used is what eats those frames. So, I mean, you know, if you're the manufacturer, you know, if you're the consumer, you're going to say, well, by golly, make something that doesn't break down in that environment. And, you know, if you're the manufacturer, that's not necessarily so easy to do when you're selling vehicles all over the world. And there's just some few select areas that have environments and, you know, where they use corrosive products that are going to cause that kind of a problem. So I don't think there's any manufacturer, you know, I know there is no manufacturer that intentionally makes something like that. We can talk about obsolescence on all kinds of products. But it's an environmental thing. So one of the important things is keeping that vehicle cleaned up in the wintertime, getting under flushes, getting that stuff off of there as soon as you can. That's not always the most easy practical thing to do, but it's that or watch it rust, you know, and take the steps to try to get it off and try to treat it and try to prevent it as much as you can. But it's a struggle. You know, we want to have clear roads in the wintertime and safety from ice. But at the same time, it eats our vehicles. It just eats them.
It does indeed. I'm thinking about windshields again. You know, last summer I was driving into the sun on the interstate, and I had my window was such a glare. I pulled over at a rest stop, and the you know, I got the light just right, and I could see the inside of my windshield was terrible. And so I did the best job I could at that point of cleaning the inside of the windshield. And I wondered how in the heck that happens. And basically, let's talk about cleaning and care for both the inside and the outside of your windshield.
Sure. You know, when I started in the automotive industry, I would say that most people smoked, and most and you know, the fog, the stuff on the inside of the windshield was primarily from cigarette smoke. But now,
I don't smoke.
But you still right, and you still see that. And what it is something we call vinyl sweat. The vinyl, the plastic that the dash is made out of, outgasses. Something that I mean, you can get other things on the inside of the windshield, but there is, you know, a phenomenon called vinyl sweat where that'll get on there, and it can be cleaned off. You know, typically, you know, I tend to use a good glass cleaner, and just give it a good cleaning, and then go back with a dry cloth, something like a terry cloth or a microfiber is even better, that you can then do a final wipe and get that all off. The outside of the windshield, obviously, you're going to have to be a little more aggressive. You know, it's funny that this, you know, with bugs over the years, I see fewer and fewer bugs on my windshield. That's not a good thing for environment that there are fewer bugs out there. But for some reason this year, I feel like I've noticed more of them, and they're not going to clean off as easy as cleaning the inside of, of the glass. So you want to be a little careful that you don't use anything too strong, you know, but in terms of like a Scotch guard or something like that, you don't want to leave marks in the glass or anything. But yeah, you want to get a good strong glass cleaner concentration on the outside of it, scrub it all down. And then again, you know, once it's dried off, you want to go over it with a microfiber towel to you just kind of buff out any kind of haze that's going to remain on there. The other thing that can happen with windshields over time, depending on, you know, how much you're exposed to dirt and sand and stuff. If you live on a gravel road, if you live on the country where you have to regularly travel on gravel roads, and you see this more and more out west. You know, we were talking about salt on roads earlier, like in Colorado, they don't primarily use salt, they use sand. It's a fine kind of sand, it's great for traction. But one of the things you'll see on windshields out west is after a car is 2 or 3, 4 years old, going into the sun, as you described, there's all kinds of pits in the windshield from that sand. And so that'll happen, you know, here too, depending on how often you end up in those kind of conditions, how much you're out in dusty, sandy, gravelly conditions, where you can get that kind of pitting. And that is not something that you know, you're going to be able to clean off, but it is unfortunately something that can happen, that the only real answer for that is replacing the windshield. But, keeping the windshield clean and on the inside and the outside is one of your best bets also to prevent that kind of fogging up we're talking about, because the more little debris and particulates there are on the glass, the easier it's going to be for condensation to cause a heavier fog on it too.
Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, was with the company for 36 years as we talk vehicle maintenance today. If you have a maintenance question or maybe another kind of question about cars to pick or whatever, I hope you'll join in. Call us at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. It's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at vehicle maintenance on the program today with our guest, Jim Ward, retired from Smart Motors Toyota after 36 years with the company. Great to have him with us. Great to have you listening in. Larry Mueller here. And let's go to Victoria in Michigan, who has a question. Hi, Victoria.
Yeah. Hi. I was wondering about the ceramic polish that you can get for your cars, if that's good for helping protect the paint, or if eventually it wears the paint. Because I do a lot of driving, and I noticed that my, grill and things like that, they seem to lose their luster, and I'm concerned about it.
Yep, the ceramic coating is far superior to wax. It is definitely a superior protective coating. You know, it's not inexpensive. It's a pretty expensive thing to do. I do think even if you have the time to wax your car or have it waxed even four times a year, I don't think it gives the protection that the ceramic coating does. But man, I swoon at the price that I see of the application of it sometimes. So it's a struggle back and forth between how much protection, you know, you feel like you have to have, you know, and the driving conditions and what you have to do. You know, if you're on the road a lot and you're seeing that kind of wear, you may feel that it's definitely worth it. But it's, you know, you may be in for some shock when you go in and price what it costs to have that done as compared to having a regular detail and just having, you know, the car waxed. But it's a superior product, superior protection. There's no question.
Thanks, Victoria. Let's go to Perry in Oconto. Hi, Perry.
Yes. I have a question about windshield wipers, but I also have a question about the body of my 05 RAV4. It's got some rust underneath that, not on the door itself, but that piece underneath or the part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that can be done with that, it just started rusting, but it's getting to be a fairly good size hole. Is it worth the money of fixing that? Can it be fixed?
It can definitely be fixed. You know, you may want to take a look. Some RAV4s had a customer support program that's kind of like a recall where they had a problem with that panel, particularly up at the front of the door. There was a seam there that wasn't sealed quite like it should be. But with any of that kind of a problem, the earlier that you address it, the less expensive it's going to be. You know, if it's a vehicle that's pretty mechanically sound and you're happy with it, you know, I would investigate what it would cost to have it fixed, because it's rust is a progressive thing. It's just going to, you know, continue and get worse and worse. So, I would check into the customer support program. It may be too late for that on an 05 to have any coverage anymore, but also, just I would get some estimates as early as possible, as soon as possible, on what it would cost to fix it. Perry, you said you had the wiper question as well?
Yeah, the wipers. There's such an array of wipers out these days.
There are.
Kind of talk about them and what is the minimum you need, or, you know, should you go for the higher-end ones?
You know, wipers are something that are affected by environment. When we clean the windshield, we've been talking a lot today about windshields and cleaning windshields. And when you wash your windshield, just a typical wash, even at the gas station, it's a good idea to clean those wipers too, because the same kind of crud forms on those wipers. You might see a spot where one little line where the wiper doesn't seem to be clearing, and may assume that wiper is torn or ruined, damaged. And it might be, but it might just be a piece of crud on it that needs to be cleaned. You know, I myself have again, I'm kind of a economical, pragmatic person. I tend to always be a little unwilling to spend the big bucks to get the best product out there, and a little skeptical that it really is going to be that much better than something more middle of the road. But you know, as with most products, there's kind of a good, better, best scenario of quality out there. You can buy the cheapest and you're probably going to get the least life out of it and the worst performance. There's the middle of the road and there's the top of the line. You know, there are wipers that are made, they say, for particularly just for winter, that have little rubber boots over the flex parts of the wiper arm that comes out to hold the wiper against it, that probably do have some advantage in winter and keeping ice and snow from freezing and building up and not allowing the suspension, little springy action that's required to keep the wiper on the glass. Well, there's some practical application for that, and they're a little more expensive. Beyond that, I tend to, you know, look for a name I recognize, Bosch. And it's, you know what, often the best wipers you can get are the ones right from the manufacturer of your car. Although, again, I would price them, they, depending on the dealership, they might be being sold for a reasonable price. They might be marked up really high. But yeah, I tend to, and here's the other thing is that wipers, they don't last forever. We live in a climate where, because they have to scrape across ice in the wintertime, and they're, you know, often scraping bugs, and depending on how often you clean your windshield, You know, if you're using your wipers and holding that washer button on for 5, 6, up to 10 seconds, when you got a bunch of bugs and dirt on the windshield trying to clean it off, you know, those wipers aren't going to last very long. I tend to look at replacing wipers about every 6 months. You know, after a winter of scraping across ice and that kind of thing, and after a summer of cleaning, I kind of expect, and generally they are worn out. So that's my perspective. I tend to buy middle-of-the-road wipers, and I replace them twice a year, and they work pretty well that way.
Perry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Christine, what's on your mind in Fond du Lac?
Good morning. I noticed that I have a little bit of rust starting to form on the joint on my car door. It's there's a stationary plate that's connected to the door, and then it kind of swivels against a pin that's hanging down, and that's where the rust is beginning to form. What can I do?
What kind of car is that?
It is an 04 Buick Regal with less than 100,000 miles on it.
And if I'm understanding right, there's the hinge, there's hinges for the door that hold it, and then there's what we call a check strap. The check strap is a little strap that is what keeps your door from just swinging closed and slamming on you. And it sounds like you're describing that where that check strap goes into the door, if I'm not mistaken. And that little mount where it goes into the door is called a pocket. And a lot of manufacturers make repair kits just for that. Some don't. And you know, you may end up being told the only way that could be fixed is to replace the door. But I don't know on an 04 Buick Regal which way that comes. But if we're talking apples and apples in here and you're talking about the door check strap pocket on the door, I would check with a body shop and find out if there isn't a kit made, you know, what they call a replaceable pocket that can be put in there. Because that rust, you know, if you leave it, it will continue to spread and it'll go, you know, beyond that pocket into the door itself. And the longer you wait, the more expensive repair it's going to become.
Yeah, that's right. Christine, thank you for calling. Good luck. Peter in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Peter.
Thanks for taking my call. I have an 08 Honda CR-V, 210,000 miles on it. I'm shooting for 250. And my headlights are getting pretty dim, and you can see there's a obvious buildup on the plastic covers housing the headlights. And I'm wondering what's the best way to refurbish that plastic cover so that it's letting the light out without diffusing it too much. Are there rubbing compounds, or is this a situation for solvents?
There are kits that are made specifically to help clean that off. You know, it's uncanny, and I've seen people do this. There's something that's in DEET in the insecticide. And I'm not recommending this, but that will break down that the top layer of that plastic. The problem with that is that then it comes back that much sooner and even worse. So, and then there are kits that you can buy in parts stores and that are abrasives that are made. Sometimes they're 2-3 part where you start with this abrasive, then you go to that one, then you go to another one that'll help clear it off. But something you might want to check into, I've been kind of really surprised, is that you start checking into the prices of replacement headlights, the headlight housing assembly, and you'll find, again, just like any given product, there's the factory brand, and then there's some aftermarket brands. You know, a couple of times I've replaced headlights on my vehicle with an aftermarket complete headlight assembly that was about $36 for the whole thing. Did it myself. It's a little bit of work. It's not rocket science. Undoubtedly, you can find a YouTube video to tell you step-by-step exactly how to replace it. So, yeah, you can go through a process to take a layer off, but that tends to be temporary, and it does tend to come back faster than it occurred the first time. Or you can look at replacing your headlights. And again, it might not be as expensive as you think it is.
Yeah. Peter, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, our guest today is Jim Ward, and he is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk about your vehicle. So I hope you'll stay with us, and I hope you'll call in with your questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, that's fine too, just email to talk@wpr.org, that's talk@wpr.org. www.mylife.org. Looking forward to hearing from you. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mealer. Larry Mealer here for WPR News. We're talking with Jim Ward about vehicle maintenance today. Jim retired as service manager at Smart Motors in Madison, worked there for 36 years. Be sure to stay with us after 12:30 today. You'll get a peek into the world of luxury vintage cars with the folks at Streetworks Exotic in Pewaukee, and they restore cars from all over the world, the high-end ones. Jim, you might have fun listening to that as well. But first, call with your questions about your own car, be it a luxury one or otherwise. Let us know what's going on with the car. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And let's go to George in Madison. George, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I have a question about my 2004 Buick Park Avenue. It has 50,000 miles on it. It's a beauty. And I know that GM had problems with either the Dexcool coolant or the intake manifold of that generation engine. And my question is, I'm wondering if I should replace the coolant that came with it, or just wait until that intake manifold starts to break down?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in preventative maintenance. You know, replacing that coolant isn't overly expensive. It may not stop the problem that may have already begun, you know, a problem with that intake manifold. But, you know, I would try replacing the coolant first.
Yeah. All right. There you go, George. Thank you for calling. Samantha in Whitehall, your turn. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 42-year-old female, and I was just wondering what are some good tips for people in their 30s, 40s, anybody, but especially women in general, for maintenance on their car that they could do easily themselves without having to take the car in, or they know what to look for so that they can take it in and it doesn't turn into a big hassle. Like, I've had some stuff on my car where I could have prevented it, but I didn't know what I was looking for, so I go for an oil change and they tell me, this is wrong here, and they show it to me, you know, and I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
You bet. That's an excellent question. You know, and ultimately, a lot of technical colleges have over the years offered courses that they call powder puff. Now, you know, I don't know that this that might seem a little sexist anymore. I'm not sure that they still call them that. But you know, I had a brother-in-law that was a very experienced mechanic that volunteered his time and taught a couple of those courses. And it isn't just women. I mean, there are plenty of women who are very mechanical, know a lot about cars. But if you are inexperienced, whatever your gender is, one of those courses is one of the best things you could do. It isn't going to teach you how to diagnose complicated problems, but exactly just as you'd said, what it is going to teach you is kind of some basic things to be aware of if something's starting to go wrong, so that you can know to do something about it before it's too late, before it becomes a more expensive problem. You know, they're not that expensive, and they tend to make them fun and have presentations that don't get overly complicated. I mean, it isn't teaching you how to overhaul your engine or, you know, do any major work on the car. But, you know, if you don't have to be mechanically inclined to do something, to take a course like that and just learn a bit more about the vehicle, because knowledge is power, and, you know, the power to prevent expensive repairs and things that didn't have to happen is something all of us would prefer that we had, you know. So I would highly encourage you to do something like that. You sound like someone who's interested in you know, being able to get a little ahead on what you might be able to learn to help you avoid other, you know, certain situations. And so I would check into it and see if any of your local community colleges, technical schools have something like that to offer.
Mark in Hayward, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I just bought a new vehicle, and I'm wondering if it's worth the money to have it undercoated to prevent rust.
You know, over the years, I've not been a big fan of undercoating, and many manufacturers, almost every vehicle that's sold has some kind of undercoating. Now, on this very program earlier, we've talked about vehicles that had, you know, problems that were related to, you know, poor materials or improper coatings that they had on the frames early on. But those are by far the exception to the rule. I would do a little checking, you know, with the manufacturer to find out what that frame's already treated with. And what, if anything, you might additionally apply to it, because you can have conflicts. You can put on a chemical that can not be compatible with what the factory already used on it, and actually create more problems than you're helping prevent. So, again, most vehicles, that really isn't necessary. You're better off to regularly clean the vehicle and put the money into getting under your washes and stuff like that in the wintertime than you are to have some additional undercoating put onto what the factory did.
There you go, Mark. Thank you for calling. Tom in Madison, we go to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I have a 2005 Buick LaCrosse with the 3.8 engine in it, and about 2 years ago, I was having a coolant leak, and I got that fixed, but over that time, I kind of did get a little hot here and there. So once I got that leak fixed, I replaced that, and then about a week later, I had to replace the sensor because it was fried too. And since then, I've replaced the thermostat two or three times, and I can't get the engine to hit temperature all the time. It runs cool, so like it probably runs at about the quarter of the halfway is fine, and normally sits at about, I'd say, 45%. But it's not even getting to that 25% that needle up, and it's throwing the coat all the time. And I don't know. Really nice thermostat in there right now, one that even, like, gradually opens up and closes. I've had a fail-safe in there, and I can't get it to go. I can't get it to get up to temp and stay there consistently.
There's lots of things that can make an engine run too hot, but running too cool almost always comes down to a thermostat problem. Ultimately, I'm wondering if your sensor or your gauge are actually reading correctly. And ultimately, there are some. It's not the easiest test in the world to do, because obviously the cooling system is a closed system and getting its temperature. But there is equipment that can be used to check what that basically you can hook up a device to the onboard diagnostics, the OBD, that kind of takes the place of the gauge, so that you can determine whether if the gauge is reading the signal that the sensor sending properly. So you're basically eliminating the gauge that way and using the sensor that's in there, and then reading the temperature off of either a laptop or a piece of equipment, a scanner that you plug in to the OBD to see what it says that the engine temperature actually is. And that's where I would start. I would want to find out if maybe the gauge just isn't reading right, because that is an odd situation. You've replaced the sensor a couple times, and I'm kind of wondering in my mind if the engine really is getting the proper temperature, and you're just not getting the correct reflection of that on the gauge. So that's the kind of testing that should be done to determine that.
Yeah, there you go, Tom. Thank you. Good luck. Mary in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I have a 2008 Toyota Solara convertible that we put in our garage for the winter. And when we come back from Florida, the dashboard, the vinyl, and the steering wheel are sticky and gray and kind of smell, and I've tried bleach and vinegar. How can we get that off, and how can we prevent it?
That 05 Solera had a design problem with the vinyl They had a customer support program. Again, it wasn't a recall. Recalls tend to be forever on vehicles. It was a limited time customer support program, which I don't know what the parameters were. So I would check with the Toyota dealer, first of all, to see if there's possibly any coverage for that for you anymore. Unfortunately, I can't tell you a good way to resolve that. They basically, the repair that they did was to replace the steering wheels and the dash with an updated design, because that vinyl broke down prematurely in the sun, and that's what this is. It isn't like your dash got exposed to some chemical or something it shouldn't have. It's a defective product that ultimately the only repair is to replace it. The other thing you can do, though, if you find out your vehicle's not in that, this wouldn't help with the steering wheel. You'd probably have to buy a steering wheel. You can get steering wheel covers, and you can also buy dashboard covers that are kind of like the material of like a floor mat. It's kind of a fabric material, but it goes over the dash and would hide that if you find that there's no support program that's going to cover replacing it.
All right, Mary, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mike in Ridgeway, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a kind of a different situation. I've got a 1974 Buick LeSabre that I got from my grandmother that's sitting in storage with only 35,000 miles on it. It's in absolute mint condition, but the problem is that I'm paying about $350 a year on storage, and you can figure out the math and what the car is worth, and I'm not sure what to do with it, and I need help because I know the longer it sits, everything from the rubber hoses to everything deteriorates, so need some help.
Any advice there, Jim?
Are you wanting to hang on to the car, or are you thinking about getting rid of the car?
I'm open to anything. You know, I'm sure someone in Milwaukee would love to chop it into a low rider because the hood on it's over 6 feet long. You can fit, you know, song about the love shack. You can fit 30 people in that car in the trunk. You could pay. It's awesome.
Awesome
car.
We don't often get into a lot of conversations about vintage cars. It's funny that I was just talking about a vintage program, but you know, you might want to check with if you list a car like that, you're gonna get you know, if you just list it for sale, you're gonna get all kinds of people that want to come and look at it and give low offers. You might check with the local car club and find out what your best avenues may be there. There definitely would be some people that would be interested in that car. You know, if you're looking at getting rid of it, and there's all kinds of things, you know, I mean, everybody has their taste. Somebody chopping it up and putting it into a lowrider is one thing. Somebody else restoring it and just keeping it the way it was would be my favorite thing to think of someone doing with it, but each of their own. But it might be worth more than you think. I mean, again, a 74 LeSabre with only 35,000, it's in that kind of shape, definitely falls into that vintage category, and you might be surprised at the interest out there in it. But rather than just putting an ad in and not knowing what's going to happen, you might contact a local vintage car club, you know, and just talk to somebody there and find out what they think. That they might probably be willing to come out and take a look at it and give you some idea of what it might actually be worth.
All right, Mike, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Keith in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 2019 Toyota Highlander Hybrid and a 2023 Toyota Sienna Hybrid. And I'm wondering what kind of life I can expect out of the hybrid batteries. Their predecessor vehicles, Toyota and a Honda, I both got 220,000. Is there any chance that I can get close to that with the hybrid batteries?
I would fully expect to. You know, like with any kind of device, an engine, a transmission, a hybrid battery, you know, there's a bell-shaped curve. Some of them fail earlier than expected, but the vast majority of those hybrid batteries, lasted as long as you'd expect an engine to last, or transmission to last in the vehicle, several hundred thousand miles. So, and the technology's only gotten better. So I don't see any reason to expect less than what you got on a previous one. I would fully expect to get 300,000 or better.
All right, Keith, there you go. Jeff emailed, a friend of mine swears by premium gasoline. I don't want to spend the extra money. What advantages, if any, are there to using premium gas?
If you don't have a vehicle that the manufacturer requires that you use premium, I would not use premium. You know, it years ago when fuel systems weren't, when fuel, like electronic fuel, fuel injection management systems have gotten pretty sophisticated. There was a time when, you know, if you weren't paying too much more for premium fuel, you might get improved enough fuel mileage to make it worth spending the difference. But the fuel system has gotten sophisticated enough now that they really are going to give you the optimum mileage, and that premium fuel is really not going to help that much. If you're just driving a typical daily driver car, not some performance car that you're out racing, doing something with, I don't see it as necessary. It's an expense I wouldn't be willing to make.
A listener emailed, how important is the correct tire pressure? They recently went to the garage and had their tires rotated, and their tire pressure was not correct. The listener fills their tires to 32 PSI, but when they got it back from the garage, it registered from 34 to 36 in different tires. What should they do? This is for a Tacoma 2020.
Tire pressure is pretty important. I mean, it there's a range. For example, you know, most modern vehicles have tire pressure monitors. There's a sensor either on the tire or a rotation sensor for the wheel. Most of them are a sensor that's actually got a receiver in the car that's reading what that air pressure is, but they've got a threshold that's not going to turn that light on until it's about 7 pounds low. That's low enough that if you're consistently running 7 pounds low, you're going to wear your tires out prematurely and wear them, you know, not evenly, because a tire that's underinflated is going to wear on the outside shoulders of the tire, as opposed to a tire that's overinflated is going to wear right in the middle treads of the tire. So, and you also then don't get the best handling. Underinflated tire is also more likely to hydroplane. We've been talking about hydroplaning today. So tire pressure is important. And although, you know, to some degree you can depend on a tire pressure warning system to keep you from running a tire completely flat, it's not going to warn you about a tire that's lower than is ideal for operation and tire life. So tire pressure is pretty important. You know, when I worked in the shop, we'd have these drills that we'd do a couple times a year where we would have everybody check their tire pressure gauge, because especially in a shop where, you know, your tech, it's one thing, our gauge at home you might use occasionally now and then, but if you are a mechanic in a shop, you're using your, you know, whatever kind of tire pressure gauge you got all the time. And so they do wear, and we do this exercise where everybody check the same tire and see various different pressures to make sure somebody was aware when they had a tire pressure gauge it wasn't accurate anymore. And, you know, you may, depending on where you get the car serviced, more and more, like at Express Lubes, they got a guy working on the left side of the car, a guy on the right side of the car, each guy working with a different gauge. If one's off a little bit, you may come out with different tire pressures from one side to the other. A couple of pounds isn't that big a deal, you know, over or under, but it is important. So getting a good tire pressure gauge, checking them regularly, is the best way to ensure that you're going to have tires that perform right under various conditions, like, you know, a lot of rain and hydroplaning concerns, and gives you the best tire life and gets the best mileage that you can get out of that tire. So pretty important. I would prefer to see people, you know, again, that's one of those things that you can definitely do yourself. Get a good gauge, you know, use it, read it, and make sure that your tires are at that correct pressure, because you know, I would bet the majority of cars running around out there are probably more than 5 pounds off.
Okay. Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed us. His company runs rigs with super singles. Yes, in Wisconsin winters. Before he got new tires, hydroplaning is a real waking up deal. After new tires, he still hydroplanes on concrete highways in the cities. Is this because of all the de-icing fluid residue from winter?
You know, I guess I'm not sure about that. I don't know what kind of rig it is that he's talking about. Generally, when we talk about a rig, I think of a heavier vehicle, and heavier vehicles tend to be less likely to hydroplane.
I think he's talking about trucks or semis or something.
Right. You know, that's just odd. I mean, here's the thing. The factors in hydroplaning are tread depth, the depth of the water, and your speed. You might be going too fast. You know, you got new tires and you're still hydroplaning. I think you might be pushing the safe speed in that depth of water. Those are the three factors. And so you got the tread depth you've addressed, the depth of the water that you're in is something that you know, you can't always tell just by looking at it, but it's not always going to be deep, you know, deep water. So if you're finding you're hydroplaning a lot, slow down.
Kathleen emailed us, their 2010 Toyota Prius liftgate is difficult to lift. It does not have an automatic control button. Is there grease or other products that would help us to open it easier? It does not appear to be rusted or corroded in any way.
Well, the liftgate is, you know, you've got hinges and you've got a little hydraulic strut that helps lift it up. I think that hydraulic strut's probably getting weak and probably needs to be replaced. And often you can even look at that strut and see that a little bit of the oil's leaked out. I mean, it's not like it's going to be dripping, but you'll be able to see that on the shaft of the strut that there's kind of an oily substance. And in what you're describing, that's usually going to be the case. You probably need what are called new liftgate struts.
Another question about back to the windshields again. How useful are products like Rain-X that make a windshield water repellent?
They're really useful. I swear by Rain-X. I use it all the time. It's amazing. It's a great product. Yep, it makes a lot of difference, and I highly recommend it. I always use it.
Well, the water just rolls off.
It does. It does. It's the kind of thing where you can. All, I'm not going to recommend this, but you know, in light rain, you can almost drive without your wipers on. I mean, the water just rolls up the windshield. When you have that on there, the windshield seems to get dirty. It takes longer for the windshield to get real dirty. Things don't want to stick to the glass as well when it's got that coating on it.
Larry lost the cap that covers the rear view mirror, the outside mirror on the Toyota Highlander. I think it was a 2003. He probably should be replaced. How expensive is it to replace?
Well, that's dependent. Sometimes they're just a stock black color, and those tend to not be very expensive. And sometimes they're the color of the vehicle. Toyota used to send all of them stock black, and if it was supposed to be colored, you had to send it to a body shop and get it painted, made it much, much more expensive. A few years ago, they started doing that all from the factory and made it a little bit less expensive, but it can vary depending on those factors. You know, it's a fairly easy replacement. You don't really usually need any tools. It snaps on. They're not completely weatherproof either, by the way. So without it, it doesn't mean that something's getting exposed to weather that isn't really going to, it'll be more exposed. You know, there's some components that will be more exposed, but they get water, saltwater stuff get up in there anyway and drain back out. So, you know, for aesthetics, it looks best if it's replaced. You know, but depending on the type you have, the price can vary a bit. But it's easily a do-it-yourself project.
Well, with that, Jim, we are out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And I think you're going to be back on July 18th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep. I think we're coming right up. Yep. It's always fun and fascinating. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, Jim. Jim Ward, he retired as the service manager at Smart Motors in Madison. And, of course, we will see him again on July 18th. Coming up, we're going to take a look at restoring vintage cars with Steelworks Exotics in Pewaukee. And they do some really expensive restorations. We'll hear that next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.